Email is not a job, but it sure behaves like it for knowledge workers moving through tasks in the workday and responding to the nonstop flow of electronic communication. We're talking about our inboxes on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One study from 2019 estimated the average worker was sending and receiving 126 business emails per day, and then checking their instant message app like Slack every 6 minutes or less. How did it come to this? Do you feel burnt out because of constant work communication? What have you done to try to limit or organize your email? 800-642-1234. Cal Newport is an associate professor of computer science at Georgetown University, author of 7 books. His latest is called A World Without Email, Reimagining Work in an Age of Communication Overload. Cal, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, good morning. And full disclosure here, our team and WPR for that matter is joined at the hip in Slack channels. You know, our morning show channel is active all day in putting this show together. I'm on a live channel this very moment communicating solely about what's going on in the live show. So give us the lowdown on what you see on Slack communication.
Well, Slack communication took what email innovated, which was an approach to work in which things are figured out through ad hoc back and forth messages, what I call the hyperactive hive mind workflow. Slack took that way of working and built an even faster, even slicker tool for implementing it. So it took a workflow that I have real problems with, but then built a better interface for it, which is why we both love and hate it. It's a better interface than email for this type of collaboration, but this type of collaboration is making us miserable.
And this constant communication by electronic messages, you've coined this term hyperactive hive mind. Give us more there. What is it?
This is really the villain of my book. It's not the tools themselves. In fact, email solved really practical problems. It replaced the fax machine, it replaced voicemail, it replaced memos, and it did so in a way that made sense. It was a better technology. But it brought with it this new way of collaboration where we say, let's just figure most things out on the fly with unscheduled back and forth digital messages. The friction is so low now that we can just figure things out on the fly. There's not too much of an obstacle to doing that. The problem with this workflow is that now you're going to have dozens of simultaneous asynchronous back and forth conversations happening at any one time. In order to keep up with all these conversations, you have to constantly check. You have to constantly check that inbox, or if you're using Slack, you have to constantly check that Slack channel. And it's that constant checking that actually causes the problem. Our brain can't shift context so quickly. So it's that hive mind driven context shifting that is really causing, I think, the productivity and misery problems with the modern workplace.
And when you say misery, you know, you have a chapter called Email Makes Us Miserable. Why does it make us so unhappy?
You know, we can measure this pretty directly. First of all, you can survey people and find, if you control for variables, that the more they interact with information communication technologies, the less happy they are. You can get more direct. You can actually put heart rate monitors and thermal cameras on office workers and see that as they open their inbox, stress reaction goes up. And so we can ask what's going on here. There's a couple things. One, we are not wired to have a piling up of communication from people that we're not able to get to in the moment. This idea that there's more messages in my inbox than I can answer right now, it conflicts with our fundamentally social wiring, in which we want to be responsive to people. We want to maintain good social relationships with our tribe. So that makes us anxious to know that at all times, communication is piling. And then also, we are not good at purely linguistic communication. Communicating just with the written word is something that humans are not wired to do. We're really bad at it. We're often misunderstood. Nuances are missed. We are frustrated about not being understood either. You put those two things together and we have a recipe for unhappiness.
Yeah. And as you said, you know, scientists say that we don't even really understand sarcasm that well. Like we misinterpret it, you know, continually.
Yeah, the written language is a really impoverished form of communication. And we take this for granted when I'm actually talking to you, either in person or even now over the radio, where I can hear your voice, I can hear your intonations, there's pacing, we are doing a sort of back and forth. Now, if we actually can see each other, there's also going to be body language. It's an incredibly rich stream of information that plays a big role in our interaction. When you strip that all away and say, okay, I'm just going to write text on the page, it's much, much difficult, which is why when you look at the great letter writers of times past, you say, wow, these letters are really flowery. They're really long. They go on for pages and pages. That's because they're trying to set the emotional context just with words. It's very complicated to do. And obviously, when we're shooting off our 126th email of the day, we're not taking that same time.
Talking about pacing here, we're talking with Cal Newport, who is a computer scientist at Georgetown, studies how the constant connectivity of digital communication is causing us to lose our concentration, not be as productive as we should be. His latest book is called A World Without Email. What are your thoughts? Are you overwhelmed by email and text and Slack messages? What strategies have you used to limit electronic messages, or do you struggle to keep up? What is your organization tactics? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You write about how IBM established an email system in the 80s, and analysts had estimated how much internal communications were currently happening and then established a server to handle that volume. What happened there?
Well, they were very careful about this provisioning of the server because servers were expensive in the 1980s. We're talking about high six figures, low seven figures. So they couldn't just over-provision. So they said, okay, exactly how much communication happens in our office? We'll build a server that can handle all of that. If all of that moves to email, the server can still keep up with it. And they melted down that server in just a matter of days. They went back and measured and found that within 3 to 4 days, the amount of communication in that office increased by a factor of 5 to 6.
Wow.
Just having the presence of this new tool, without any memos from up above, without any all-hands meetings about how we're going to change our workflows, without a lot of new books on communication productivity, just having that tool drastically changed the way that people collaborated.
Okay, so then what happens as this starts piling up? You see this at other companies as well. What is corporate saying? Is there any type of guidelines or you know, even any science on what to do with all this electronic communication?
You know, it's an interesting story because when it comes to the issues of the hive mind, unlike other issues we see that are causing, for example, dissatisfaction in the workplace, most stakeholders are aligned. In other words, the people who own the companies are just as unhappy about the hyperactive hive mind as the people who work there because it makes people less productive and it generates burnout and turnover. So it was this mystery I was trying to solve. Why aren't we changing this? And one of the big answers to that question is that knowledge work, almost alone among most industrial sectors, has a real commitment to autonomy. And for various reasons I uncovered, we think in knowledge work that how work gets done should be left up to the individual. You know, buy a book on personal productivity, get a planner. I don't know. That's up to you. What we do as managers is we give you objectives. It's management by objectives, but you have to figure out how to do your work on your own. So we do not have a culture within office work of thinking systemically about how work is organized, how tasks are assigned, how we keep track of who's working on what, how we communicate and coordinate about things. We don't think that way in knowledge work. It's not part of the office work culture. So it's in that autonomy trap, that culture of autonomy, that there's a really ineffective way of collaborating that's very easy and convenient. I mean, it's not surprising that we drift to it. It sticks because there's no real existing culture of looking at those type of things and asking how we can change them.
And in the process of organizing, I mean, some amazing statistics, like for an executive, it might have taken 6 hours to prioritize all of the different tasks. I mean, there is just an influx of whether it's digital communication or just tasks that are put to the person.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point. And we're beginning to see more cultural commentary and backlash against this idea that we're too busy. Now, if you dig deeper into this, you see there really does seem to have been an explosion in the average number of, let's say, obligations on the plate of the average knowledge worker. Now, that 6 hour number came from David Allen's productivity classic, Getting Things Done. Now, that came out in the early 2000s after email and some of these technologies had flown. But the interesting thing about that book is he talked about how it could take multiple days just to go through this initial step when he was consulting with executives to write down everything on their plate. Days, hours and hours of sweeping through all these obligations that are in their brain, in inboxes, in random pieces of paper. You go back 10 or 15 years before that was not the case. You know, if you go back and to say 1985 and say, what's the main productivity tool? It would be a day runner calendar. You'd have three things on your calendar. You look at a Franklin Covey planner, you know, there might be a space for seven or eight tasks that you're working on at the time. So there really was an explosion of the amount of work on our plate that is concurrent with the arrival of low friction digital communication tools. And I think that's more than just a correlation. I think there's really some causation there.
We're talking with Georgetown's Cal Newport, wants us to think critically about what he calls the hyperactive hive mind workflow, why it's bad for productivity, our overall well-being. Has your employer tried to lessen the burden of work communication in your organization? What strategies have they used? Can you imagine a world without email? Are there other tools or apps that you've tried that have made you more productive? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Cal Newport here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about constant multitasking in a world flooded with electronic communication at work. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The modern knowledge worker, Cal Newport writes, is almost never more than a few minutes away from sending or receiving some sort of electronic communication. To say we check email too often is an understatement. The reality is that we're using these tools constantly. Do you find that even when you're not on the clock, you're responding to work emails or messages? What limits have you tried to set? What has helped? Join in 800-642-1234. We have Georgetown Associate Professor of Computer Science, Cal Newport, who studies distributed systems and workplace communication. He's with us for the hour. Peter is joining us from Middleton. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Good morning. I find this fascinating. My corporate work life spanned from 1983 until my retirement in January of this year. So I saw technology come and just, I think what happened was that this email thing, I was working for a large insurance carrier, and I realized my staff, which part of their job was to be out and visit clients, their excuse was, well, I did email today and I did email yesterday, right? And so we created a task force, which included the president of the company, to deal with this issue, right? And we met for weeks on end, and how do we handle emails? And this is probably 2005, 2008. And our conclusion, I want to hear Cal's response to this, because I think it was comical. Our final report conclusion was that the managers, and they should encourage their employees to start earlier and handle their emails before 8 o'clock, and then go out and do their task, and then come back and work later, and then finish their emails at the end of the day.
Mm.
The conclusion.
Wow. Cal.
Well, I agree that it is a comical solution, and things have actually gotten worse. So now the solution actually reverses that. We do email and meetings all day long and do our actual work early in the morning or after work hours. So it's gotten even worse, but I think it gets to the deeper underlying problem, which is the issue of the hyperactive hive mind cannot be fixed at the level of the inbox. We can't fix it with our rules or habits for how we interact with our inbox or when we interact with it. We actually have to do the hard work of replacing the hive mind with specific, clear, alternative ways for collaborating. We have to do that hard work of saying, we don't just shoot off an email to figure this out. Here's our rules for doing this type of work. We don't just jump on Slack to take care of these type of issues. Here is our process for doing that. That's ultimately going to be the solution to this issue.
What about, you know, email-free Fridays or things like that? What have you seen there?
Those consistently fail, and I think it's because, again, it's trying to solve this problem at the level of the inbox. And the reason why this doesn't work is that if your underlying implicit agreement about how you're going to collaborate is the hyperactive hive mind, you actually do need to be checking that email inbox. If things are being figured out with asynchronous back and forth ongoing conversations, if you're not involved in those conversations for an entire day, they all grind to a halt. So the hyperactive hive mind actually necessitates that you check the inbox all the time. So we used to think about this as a problem of personal habits. We would say it's an addiction. You just need to check your email less often. We should just have better norms about when you do or don't check your email. None of that is going to work if the underlying workflow is the hyperactive hive mind, because it actually does rationally demand checking all the time. So I think email-free Fridays have failed for exactly that purpose, is because those became unproductive Fridays. You got to fix the underlying workflows. prevent those emails that need your attention from getting the inbox in the first place. It's much more successful than saying try to ignore emails that need your attention as long as possible.
Talking with Cal Newport, who teaches computer science at Georgetown University, his book explores how we can be more focused in an age of digital distractions. His new book is called A World Without Email. Can you imagine such a world? What is email like in your organization? Have there been fixes? 800-642-1234. Cal, I want to dig into something a little bit more fully here, and that is productivity, because you argue that email is making us less productive. How does electronic communication interfere with us concentrating and getting our work done in these chunks of time?
The biggest problem we have as humans in this context is that we can't change our attention quickly. Now, this differs from computer processors, and I think the metaphor of the computer processor, which is dominant in Silicon Valley, where a lot of these tools were created, has been causing an issue here, because a computer processor is entirely agnostic to what operation is executing. You just pipeline up as many operations as you can, and it just executes. It doesn't care what it is. It all takes the exact same amount of time. The human brain, by contrast, it's a messy network of neurons. It can take 10, 15 minutes to fully change our cognitive context from one focus to another. We have to suppress some neural networks. We have to amplify others. There's these tertiary and secondary semantic connections in the brain. So we're much slower than, say, a computer processor to turn from one context to another. The issue is when we check our inbox every 5 minutes, every time we do one of those checks, we are introducing a novel information context, including requests from people that we know. They're social ties. It's urgent from a cognitive standpoint. So we initiate a very expensive context switch. But we're just looking, let's say, for a quick email. So then we abort that context shift and try to come back to the original thing we're working on. That collides with the old networks. This all piles up. And the result from a neurological perspective is fatigue and anxiety and difficulty thinking clearly. It's why we find ourselves by 1 or 2 in the afternoon, basically just giving up on work and giving in to just checking our inboxes, is because our brain can't go back and forth that fast.
You actually talked with a company leader in Germany who has a 5-hour workday, quite a contrast to what Peter just told us about at that insurance company. What does a 5-hour workday have to do with this?
Well, the way he was able to get the 5 hours is they got very clear about how work should actually happen. And that included email communication. They got very specific that email is only used for very specific purposes. They added much more structure to how their work unfolded. They don't work with their phones nearby. They don't jump on email for all issues. They're very careful about scheduling meetings. So they got intentional about how the work actually unfolded, as opposed to doing what most companies do, which is saying, hey, productivity is personal, figure it out. Because of that, they found when they went down to 5-hour workdays, and these are true 5-hour workdays, you are not allowed to communicate with the office or each other after it's roughly 2 or 3 in the afternoon when they're done, they get all their work done. So by being clear about here is how we actually work, they were able to squeeze out a huge amount of the inefficiency that comes from just doing that in an ad hoc manner.
But, you know, managers in particular have gazillions of hours of meetings a week. I mean, lots and lots of meetings. What is your sense there of the weight of these meetings, especially in the pandemic, versus this isolated time of working through projects and, you know, priorities?
So meetings are dichotomous. On the one hand, real-time communication is often significantly more efficient for collaborating with someone or reaching a decision or getting information than back and forth asynchronous communication, like sending emails back and forth. On the other hand, I think we saw during the pandemic, a lot of office workers who were newly remote found their days entirely taken up by Zoom. So we can also have on the other side of this meetings that get out of control and really dominate your day. So what's really going on there? Well, as far as I can tell, what happened with the Zoom overload is that when we took all friction out of setting up a meeting, I can just shoot off an invite. I don't have to make people walk across the office building. I don't have to see people walk into the room with their coffees and looking a little bit upset that they have to be there. I don't have to reserve a room. When we got rid of all the friction, we began using meetings as a proxy for productivity. Oh, there's a new obligation on my plate. I'm not super organized. The one productivity tool that I trust that I do use is my calendar. So let me just get a meeting on my calendar because I know we'll talk about it then. Good. I don't need to think about it. everyone started using meetings in this way, and we soon had way too many of them.
And then you start delaying the meetings, you know, can we schedule for next week, or, you know, what's good for you? And there becomes an email thread or a very long one.
Yeah, see, meetings are great when they are part of a very intentional thought through process for getting a certain type of work done. Mm. So if you look at software developers, for example, a typical software development firm running an agile project methodology, these status meetings are key for them, but they last 15 minutes a day at a set time. So they're using meetings, but the meetings are very strategic.
Hmm. Computer scientist Cal Newport of Georgetown explaining the problems, the stress created by constant electronic communication, proposing how we could structure a different system. What's the longest you're able to go without checking email or Slack? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking candidly about our task lists at work and the stress of electronic communication. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Have you tried what's called batching your emails as a possible solution? Dealing with emails all at once or checking messages once a day, maybe twice? Managers, are you giving employees predictable time off to disconnect from email, from Slack, to recharge? Has your organization replaced email with a better workflow? What is it? Join in 800-642-1234. Georgetown University computer science professor Cal Newport has researched why email is making us less productive. He's with us for the hour. Cal, before we get deep into solutions, I want you to talk about this story about President Obama's Director of Innovation and Entrepreneurship, who was, you know, his work meant working with dozens of federal agencies, 500 universities, distributing, you know, $100 million in funding. But right after he starts the job, his office loses email. What happened?
It was a fascinating natural experiment for trying to understand the advantages and disadvantages of how we communicate. So there was a computer virus that went through their network. So the Department of Homeland Security came in and said, look, we have to take your computers because we don't know if this is from a foreign actor, there are security concerns. We're going to literally take the computers out of your office. Oh, and by the way, because of security regulations, you can't use your personal email to do this work. So for a period of 6 weeks, this hyper-connected typical DC shop was without email. And there is obviously disadvantages. The main thing that his name was Nish, who was running this team. The main disadvantage was scheduling. So it was really a pain because the White House, of course, was using email to schedule everything and they felt outside of the loop. The advantage, however, is that it gave him what he called white space, time to actually take in information and think. And so he started actually going around, going to the offices of the people they'd be working with, having these long discussions with them to really understand their needs and what's going on in their particular sectors. And during this 6 week period, because of that white space, most of the main ideas that they then executed throughout the rest of his time there in DC came out of that period.
Hmm. And between these face-to-face long conversations in person, he wasn't frantically trying to keep up with email or check email because it wasn't there.
And I suggested to him at the end of this conversation, I said, you know, the things you said that you needed email for, the scheduling, the latest announcements from the White House, etc., couldn't you have just hired one person to do that? And then you could still have all the advantages of the white space and not constantly needing to be checking the email. And there was this long moment of silence on the line because I think the initial instinct was like, well, that'd be crazy. And then his brain clicked and he said, but why would that be crazy? And I think in that pause, we get to the whole seed of this book idea is, do we really need to have everything be handled all the time through constant unbroken conversation? Maybe that is less fundamental than we assumed.
So what solutions have you found for how workers can get a handle on email, can put the focus on their jobs?
It all comes back to process engineering. So we have to ignore the inbox, our habits, are we batching, what's our norms? That's all a distraction. We have to instead look at the underlying, what I call processes, the things that us or our team or our company do again and again, the things we come back to again and again, our main operations. And for each, we actually have to do the hard work of asking the question of, how do we actually want to implement this work? Where is the information stored? How do we assign the task? How do we keep up with the task? When and where and how do we communicate about this process? And this is a non-simple thing to do. It takes a lot of experimentation. It takes buy-in from everyone involved. But basically what we're trying to do here is prevent the avalanche of unscheduled messages that need responses from arriving in the inbox in the first place. I'm largely indifferent to advice about how to deal with an overwhelming number of unscheduled messages already in your inbox. To me, that's not so interesting. We've tried that for 15 years. It doesn't help. I want to solve the underlying problem of, let's get serious about how we actually are going to work together. We can't just keep winging this in an electronic sense.
And putting yourself at the center here, you have tried to kind of manage two different email addresses for your professor work versus, you know, working with postdocs, kind of separate those two lives and then work on those two different roles accordingly. How does that work out?
Well, you know, I actually have six email addresses.
Oh,
because
okay.
Once you think about your work from this process perspective, and then for each of the here's a process, something I do again and again, how do I want to implement communication for that? It really changes the way you think about communication. So yeah, I do have an address that I use for my collaborators, my students, my postdocs. I have another address that's for more of the administrative communication associated with my professor job. I do not have a general purpose address for myself as a writer. I do have special purpose addresses as a writer. For example, there's an address called interesting@calnewport.com where my readers can send me tips and articles and links. But because it's not my name, it's actually associated with a process, they're completely happy with this expectation that, oh, I'm not going to necessarily respond to those. This is not a way to start a back and forth correspondence, but it is a way to send things that I do appreciate and I will see. So once you start thinking about processes and how do I want to implement these processes, it opens up a whole new landscape of different configurations for your work.
At the end of the day, though, you want to be faithful to your company. You want to get the work done. You know, what advice would you have to make sure that things just don't fall through the cracks?
Well, again, this is where the process-based thinking is really good. And the old way of thinking about the email problem is bad. And the old way says, let's just think about how we interact with our inbox. Maybe we should batch, or maybe we should have better expectations about when we respond. And that generates the issues you're talking about. You know, there's a study I talked about in the paper where they measured the stress level of workers that they asked to batch their email checking. And that stress level went up, right? Because as they were waiting to get to their once or twice a day email checks, they knew there was lots of things piling up that needed their attention that they were ignoring, that they were making other people's lives difficult, which is really stressful. And so those type of old fashioned responses to email, how do I change just my habits and how I interact with my inbox? That's where those issues of not being responsible come up. That's where the issues of non-responsivity comes up. When we take a process-centric approach and say, oh, here's something that we do again and again as a company. We answer questions from clients or something. Let's figure out how we want to do that in a way that gives really good information to our clients. They trust it. It's clear. But it also cuts out this need for these to show up at any point, causing us to constantly check our inboxes, for example. When you focus on the processes, you're focusing on not just how do we want to communicate, but doing so in the context of how do we want to communicate in such a way that gets this work done. It's much more intentional. It's much more detailed. And I really think it's the way forward here.
We're talking with Cal Newport. His new research is at the intersection of digital work and human productivity. His latest book is called A World Without Email. Have you found more productive ways than your email inbox to communicate with your colleagues? Have your employers tried to lessen the burden of work communication at your office? Or is it going largely ignored? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Cal, getting others on board, you talked about this terse, somewhat automatic reply, email reply that explained how a person was checking their email through the day. And that seemed to go by the wayside. What did you see there?
Well, the main, I think, psychology at play when you're trying to make changes is that if someone feels like they had no say in a change that's going to affect them, their natural instinct will be resistance. So if you just tell someone, I'm checking my email less, you're basically saying you had no say in this and I'm going to make your life harder. that's going to generate resistance. A much more effective way of changing work habits is to make sure that the relevant people are all involved. If a team gets together and decides together, here's how we're going to communicate, that will stick. If you make personal changes into how you're working with your inbox, it's usually better not to advertise them. You do not want to trigger that psychological heuristic that means, whoa, I had no control here. I don't like this. I would say just keep it quiet. Just execute the changes. Apologize if you need to, but you might be surprised by how little people notice.
Yeah. You know, if communication this way has been, you know, has been so burdensome and making people miserable, why aren't companies more apt to change this or more apt to talk about this?
Well, again, I think this autonomy trap I talked about before plays a big role here. There is actually a single management theorist. His name was Peter Drucker. He coined the term knowledge work in the 1950s and introduced this notion of management by objectives. He really beat the drum throughout the second half of the 20th century that we have to leave knowledge workers to be autonomous. And I think it's a big shift. It's a big shift in management thinking to say, wait a second, maybe we need to get more involved in asking and answering these questions about how work actually unfolds. Now, I think we're getting there. It's definitely the sense I get when I talk to C-suite types, when I talk to investors, when I talk to managers. There's this awareness that there is a huge amount of productivity being left on the table if we can just get past this hyperactive hive mind moment. So I'm optimistic, but it's that autonomy trap, I think, that slowed us down getting to newer ways to work.
It's kind of like saying, hey, you sort it out on your own. This is the deal. This is how everyone's doing it. So either get on board or else.
And it came from a really rational place. You know, Drucker had been analyzing General Motors right before this point. So what he was trying to say was, you can't break down knowledge work into a step-by-step assembly line like you can building an Oldsmobile. Right. Mm-hmm. And he was right about that. And at the time, that was a really big point that needed to be heard. I think the issue is, though, is that we took this autonomy in how we execute our work, which I think makes a lot of sense. And we expanded it also to cover how we organize our work. It was that over expansion, that over interpretation of the autonomy that Drucker was talking about that led to this issue.
Cal Newport of Georgetown University researches connectivity, the knowledge worker. Do you think you'd be happier if email didn't exist? Can you imagine doing your work without it? What would that be like? Do you use a collaboration program that organizes your projects into boards? We're going to be getting to that, like a whiteboard with sticky notes. Still time to talk about this. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Cal Newport here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Computer scientist Cal Newport, he writes in his book that work is not just about getting things done. It's a collection of messy human personalities trying to figure out how to successfully collaborate. What if you took email out of the equation? How do you manage a work culture that is entrenched in constant connectivity? The book is called A World Without Email, and Cal Newport is with us for about 10 more minutes. Margaret is joining us from Racine. Hi, Margaret. What is your tool you want to talk about?
Oh, heavens. I work with a lot of different tools. I work for a technology company that has process design software, workflows. If you are involved in specific processes, you receive notifications using that software. If you're not, you don't know anything about it. It's one of the problems, I think, with email, when everybody CCs 20 different people and it has nothing to do with you. Enterprise project management software, collaboration tools. I don't like to use product names because I'm not endorsing, but think of large instant messaging platforms that I can get to somebody directly without sending an email. I can set up teams for that specific purpose. So if I've got a specific customer account where there's 10 people that generally need to know status on that, I use that instead. And then there are collaboration software platforms that allow you to, you know, put any documentation that's out there that's relevant to just a small group of people. And it's a way of life. At our company. And by the way, 90% of us work from home and have been for 15 years. So it's just part of the culture.
Yeah, Margaret, thanks so much. Cal, you know, Margaret's speaking your language here on process design softwares.
Well, and the last thing she said, I think, is an interesting observation that I've been finding, too. When you look to remote work, the companies that have had a real easy time with that almost always are companies that already had in place much more structured ideas about how they collaborate. The hyperactive hive mind, let's just figure it out on the fly, does not translate well to remote work. What you end up with is 8 straight hours of Zoom and email and a desperate hurry to try to get real work done before your kids wake up in the morning. So that's another point I want to underscore there, is that structuring how we work not only makes us more productive, but makes remote work much more feasible.
Let's talk about these boards that you have, and you know, how you and I will name a name here. You appreciate an app called Trello, this platform Trello. Can you explain how this works?
Right, and there's many different competitors here that all do something similar. It's a virtual board that you pin cards onto. The cards are arranged in columns. So, I mean, these existed, of course, in the physical world. They were cork boards and index cards and push pins, and now you can do them digitally. I call them task boards. It's a really useful tool for trying to organize among a team all the things that are happening, that need to be done, that are happening, all of the relevant information for the things that need to happen and what their status is. You can capture all of that on just one board. This is a far superior approach than instead having that same information haphazardly distributed through a dozen different inboxes, spread over dozens of different messages, mixed in with completely unrelated messages. So actually externalizing the information relative to your work or to a project, making it transparent, making it clear, it's just one of many things you can do to get away from the hive mind, be a little bit more structured about how you get things done.
And with these task boards, you know, you are in control of your interaction with it. It's not just, you know, a barrage of emails hitting you whether you want it or not.
Yeah, because once you're keeping all of the information, the tasks, the projects for a particular project in one place, this is going to induce a much more structured way of updating this. Typically, what you'll then get is some sort of status meeting. These can be very structured and very fast. Okay, let's all stare at this same virtual board. Who's working on what? How did that go? What are you working on now? Great, let me move that card over to a new column to reflect its status. What do you need from other people to get that done? Great. We'll check back in tomorrow. So once you actually have a centralized place to keep the information just for one project, it naturally leads to much more structured ways of communicating about that project. So it's a 1-2 punch of benefits that get you away from just, I'm shooting emails left and right and just hoping progress is made.
Where do the clients fit in on this structure? The clients who have, you know, to have a question that they need answered.
So one of the things that seems to be clear about clients is that clarity is often much more important than accessibility. So when you have a client that demands constant accessibility, that's usually because there is no real clarity about how they get information from you. They don't trust that you're going to keep track of things. They don't trust that they're going to get an answer. They don't want to keep track of this question just in their head forever. So they'd rather you just answer them right away so they can cross that off their list and move on. But I document case after case in the book of when companies give much more clear and structured ways of interacting with their clients, the clients are happy with it. Because what they really want is just clarity. Okay, if I have a question, how does that get answered? I want to make sure that when it does get answered, I don't have to worry about it. If you give them such a system, they will be happy. Even if that system requires them to wait or to submit the question to a questions address set up for them and they get an immediate response that says this will be looked at, you'll have an answer in 48 hours or whatever it is. Accessibility is not really what people want. It's clarity.
And with your task boards, you also, when you move them around or something shifts to a different board, you send like a status update?
I do. So when I'm looking at my board for a particular role, and I want to point this out that I keep different boards for different roles. I treat different roles in my life like separate jobs. My role as a teaching professor is different than my role as a writer, which is different than my role as a research scientist. And so I keep track of what I have to do for each of those on a separate board. Because when I'm working on one role, I don't want to be thinking about work related to the other roles. When I review these boards and I move, let's say, a card from, you know, one column to another, here's a question someone had for me, and now I looked into it, made some progress. That's my cue to perhaps send an update. Here's where that is. The key point here being is that all the things I'm responsible for is stored in one place. I can see it. It's not hidden. There's nothing being kept track of in my head or in an inbox. It's very clear. Here's everything that's going on. And it makes it much easier to figure out what to do next.
We're talking with Cal Newport, a computer scientist who studies workplace systems. And you can join in 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us from Gills Rock. Hi, Lynn. You're a retired consultant.
Yes, I am. I retired about 8 years ago, and I did consulting along this line for about 20 years, primarily high-tech, large projects like designing and building satellites, overhauling submarines, and things like that for a lot of different large organizations. And I totally agree with all the ideas about the multitasking and the email. Our focus was on helping these large projects and corporations identify who were the few critical resources that this was most critical for and that were actually affecting the productivity. So we had some methods. It was based on a concept called the GOAL, written or developed by a person named Ellie Goldratt. He wrote a book about it. He's deceased now. And we would help these companies with some tools identify who on any given day was the critical resource or the subset of small critical resources, and then help train them to understand that they shouldn't be disturbed by things like emails, even from their boss or their boss's boss or their boss's boss's bosses or whatever. Hmm. And the key thing was to let the whole organization and the whole project know on any given day who those critical people were for moving the project forward as quickly as possible.
And like the point people, if you will, on the project. Who is that what you're saying?
Yes, we called it the critical chain,
okay.
Like a critical path in a project. And we would get them to agree, and they would agree that their bosses wouldn't send them emails during the day when they were working, or they wouldn't have to answer their boss's emails except for maybe in the morning or in the afternoon. Their coworkers were not supposed to send them emails. They were supposed to help them. If this critical resource sent an email to you, you were actually supposed to drop what you were doing and help them.
Lynn, thank you. Cal, the critical chain.
Well, so this is an idea that's really taken off more recently in software development as well. They tend to use the terminology of a sprint, but this is now accepted a lot in software development that, okay, this team is working on this feature, and until they finish this, that's all they're doing. And no, you can't email them, and no, you can't try to set up a Zoom meeting, and no, you can't expect them to jump on your Slack call. We want them to do nothing but work on this feature. It might take them 2 or 3 days until they're done. More generally, this is where we see a lot of the innovation right now in this process reengineering, is when we get to these boundaries between office work and manufacturing. In manufacturing, we're used to doing process reengineering, but when we see people who are on those boundaries, like software engineers or project managers for engineering projects, that's where we're seeing a lot of the innovation starting to happen.
Cal, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Cal Newport is an associate professor of computer science at Georgetown University. His book is called A World Without Email, Reimagining Work in an Age of Communication Overload. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.